Welcome. Nice to see you all. So we're gathering today to listen to Shimon Salam and Idris Robinson read a couple of short pieces, I believe. And after we're done listening to their reading, we're going to open up the floor to questions and just discussion is what I was thinking. Also, all of these zines everywhere are free, and people should come take them. Okay, do you want to, who's starting? All right.
Yeah. All right. Hi, everyone. All right. So I'm going to start, turn the mic up. Turn my mic up. Turn up my headphones. Can you hear me now? Yes, yes. Okay, word. All right. So I wrote this. I finished it in October or November. So this is an oldie. It was about the reaction, the movement's reaction to the to Michael Reinhold's killing of a fascist and his subsequent execution. And Shimon told me to say a little more about it. So usually when the movement or a group of people come to one conclusion immediately, I'm typically skeptical. And that's how I felt about Reinhold and the denunciations. So I'm suspicious of this because I think there's certain ingrained programming by the state that comes up in these times of collective consensus so quickly. The other two things I wanted to say is that when I also wanted to say that, like Hegel once said, there are plebs of every classes, so when I use the term black, I don't mean skin color, identity, or ethnicity. I think of it as there are blacks of every race, right? So it's something that's intimately tied to the dissolution of the United States of America. And with that said, all right, I'll read this one. And if it's too long, just tell me shut up, all right? Dear Michael Reinhold, I must begin by apologizing for not writing you sooner. That is to say, sorry for getting this letter to you before it was all over, or better, before they decided to take it upon themselves to end it, and had subsequently finished you off in the process. However, if there's any consolation that we can hold on to in all this, then it is, as you and I both know well, that nothing is ever really over. As the old slogan goes, nothing stops, everything continues. Believe me, I will totally understand if there's simply no forgiveness left in that big heart of yours, since we all let you down when you needed us most. The sad fact of the matter is that everyone on our side is looking for the next John Brown, but when he finally appears before us, we instead line up to unanimously reject him. Later on, I think most of us will come to acknowledge the tragedy in allowing history to repeat itself again. Yet very few will have the honesty to admit that you and your children were sacrificed so that we could continue to live our farcical lives of fear and shame. What I mean is that there will be those who continue to bear false witness. Blah, 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 blah. Even though it is impossible to deny that it was none other than old Brown who manifested himself through you, it is obvious to anyone who is courageous enough not to turn away that the piercing stare that the two of you share in common is in fact one and the same. Indeed, it showed itself as you sat in that wooded grove where the unmistakable fire in your eye made the silent pledge, which was also proclaimed in the black and white image of the great 19th century abolitionist with his palm raised. It is the look of a person, man or woman, who has declared eternal war with slavery. It all happened so fast, and almost immediately, in the very next instant, so many of those who stood beside you found a convenient way to forsake those bonds by expressing worries, instead of using their words to strengthen the collective commitments of solidarity. Above all, what indicated the implicit hypocrisy in the whole matter was how quickly they arrived at certain conclusions before they had a chance to learn the details. The fact that it somehow did not manage to cross their minds that what had happened was more likely a legitimate case of self-defense is rather telling in and of itself. Since the uprising began, the list of those martyred by white supremacists, with or without a badge, continues to grow almost daily. Calvin Harton, Sean Monterosa, Sarah Grossman, Atalia Kelly, Marquise Toussaint, Malik Graves, Victor Cazares, Robert Forbes, Oluyantin Salu, Victoria Sims, and Eric Salgado. And in the same week, when you set the course with your bold decision to act, we lost two other momentous figures of your stature in Kenosha, Anthony Huber and Joseph Rosenbaum. Since it is the martyr's blood that is the most precious and not abstract human life, I have to accept all the fault for inevitably leaving out names that demand to be repeated again and again. Thus, as we witness with each day, with each week, and each month, another human being destroyed by firearms and automobiles, the question then poses itself more falsely. Why did their initial assumptions stray from the predictable instance of self-defense, which you would later confirm in that final interview? On the other side, there is no black person, unless they are complete and total Uncle Tom, who would have even a second thought about giving you the benefit of the doubt here. This is because the course of our lives has shown us that anyone who plays with guns as recklessly as the fascists do, eventually and unsurprisingly, gets themselves shot. To put it bluntly, if we were talking about an inner city gang affiliate instead of a member of the far right, then there would certainly be no discussion about any of this at all. What the double standard with regard to your situation reveals is how violence in America will always have necessarily a profoundly racial dimension. And it's precisely this, the terrifying core of racialized violence, that they are trying to repress when they lie to both themselves and others that the issue that they had with what you did was a question of strategy or tactics. I mean, give me a break. In a country that is literally saturated in violence, from blind mass shooters to murderous police, no one can honestly claim that the few shots that you let off could somehow be construed as an act of escalation. There is simply no way to avoid the spiral of violence that began the very moment that the first wooden ships reached the shore of the Atlantic. In truth, when considering the veritable industry that has been constructed to promote victimhood, where everyone except the most wretched is capable of cashing in, what they are afraid of is not so much ending up in on the smoky side of a barrel of a gun. Instead, what they are really afraid of is having another person's blood on their hands. Put better, it is what is implied by spilling another person's blood that constitutes their deepest fears. It would mean that they would finally have to believe in something, that is, believe in something beyond themselves. Such a choice would necessarily involve a conscious transgression, crossing over a dangerous boundary, at the edge, at the limits, where whiteness ends. And once it has been breached, they could never find their way back. What I'm trying my best to get at, albeit poorly, is what Walter Benjamin had once struggled to explain about the ethical stakes of the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." Those who base a condemnation of all violent killing of a person by another on the commandment are therefore mistaken. It exists not as a criteria of judgment, but as a guideline for actions of persons and communities who have to wrestle with it in solitude, and, in exceptional cases, to take upon themselves the responsibility for ignoring it. But those thinkers who take the opposite view, the doctrine of the sanctity of life, and profess that the higher than happiness and justice of existence stands existence alone, as certainly as the last proposition is false, indeed ignoble, it shows the necessity of seeking the reason for the commandment no longer in what the deed does to the victim, but what it does to God and the doer. The proposition that existence stands higher than just existence is false and ignominious, if existence is to mean nothing other than mere life. As holy as they come, John Brown fought with utmost religious sincerity exactly this internal battle within himself. By contravening the prohibition against murder at Pottawatomie, at Harper's Ferry, he drew a line that elevated truth and justice above life itself. It demonstrated that all life will remain senseless and barren so long as there are those reduced to abject servitude. And yes, Michael, you did the same when in protecting both you, yourself. Yes, Michael, you yourself and your friends, you brought to reality the chant otherwise carelessly echoed that no lives matter until black lives matter. Such a conversion of words into deeds inherently involves a fundamental transformation of self. This is what Benjamin meant when he said that it is more about what is done to the doer than done to the victim. Once again, in this context, this has a irrevocably racial significance. To some extent, it boils down to the plain fact that I know so many white people who have never been in a fist fight, but conversely, when you grow up black, your grandmother won't let you back in the house unless you stand up for yourself and throw hands. It is for this reason I can so readily dismiss purported strategic concerns as irrelevant, because we are taught to fight even when we are sure we'll to lose to a stronger opponent. In the larger struggle against America, it is clear that in the same way, we have both nothing to lose and nothing to gain, except that something that is higher that could only be abandoned by giving in. It's like James Baldwin once said, those who are forced to snatch humanity out of the fire of cruelty, whether they survive or not, still come to know something that no church or school could ever teach. For others to accept this wager is to perpetrate the ultimate betrayal of their own whiteness. It is to become an abolitionist. Conducting his raid, John Brown assumed precisely this peculiar blend of hope and despair in order to affirmatively take up his position on death ground. Accordingly, his willingness to act was wholly reflected in his character. In this regard, there was always something about the account offered by the historian Margaret Washington that has stayed with me. Quote, it's important to understand what an anomaly John Brown was during his time as far as his attitude towards African people of African descent was concerned, because John Brown considered himself a complete egalitarian. It was very important for him to practice egalitarianism on all levels. And even other abolitionists, as anti-slavery as they were, the majority of them did not see African Americans as equals. Well, John Brown was not like that. For him, practicing egalitarianism was the first step towards ending slavery. And African Americans who came in contact with him knew this immediately. He made it very clear that he saw no difference, and he did make this clear not by saying it, but made it clear by what he did. For a lack of better formulation, it could be said that common sense is very white, whereas good sense is totally anti-white. What this entails is that much of the academic debate about race, which has now become everyday parlance, is actually besides the point. It is neither about biological nor the social basis of race. Whiteness is to be measured in the degrees in which a person clings to the last vestiges of this dying and doomed country. It is to maintain faith in the same constitutional protections that your summary execution again proved to be empty. It is to nourish the feelings for a racist family member who still manages to elicit affection and love. It is to believe that a job is deserved at a firm where the darker employees can only clean up. In short, it is to this extent to which a person embodies life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is worthwhile to note that, according to the standard evaluation, it follows that many people who are called black instead must be judged white. In order to fend off its own dissolution, white supremacist society tells us that there's nothing more insane than wanting to be born with black skin. This is how they present Rachel Dolezal to us. John Brown was forced to wear this label for more than a century. The military-industrial complex? Or like the bootleg version of it, right? John Brown was forced to wear this label for more than a century, and it will unfortunately be attached to you, Michael, for some time to come. However, this situation, this is nothing but a protection of a far more widespread clusters of pathologies pervading white America, a situation in which opiates and self-inflicted wounds have become the only means to temper the pain of a rapidly disintegrating personal relationships. Likewise, the dire emotional state of the individual is being mirrored in the way that the country as a whole is crumbling before our eyes. To be precise, I'd say that the American government is doing its best to overthrow itself, at least when Trump was around. Yet, so accustomed to disappointment, I should expect that some of the loudest voices within the movement to express their skepticism, a defeatist attitude, and acquired a defensive posture of reluctance. It brings to mind the old chapter report on the SDS Regional Council distributed by Up Against the Wall Motherfucker. A white radical is three parts bullshit, one part hesitation. It is not revolutionary and should not be stockpiled at this moment. Despite certain grandiose delusions of white mastery and control, it is becoming increasingly evident that civil war is inescapable. It is not up to anyone. Rather, it is a play of forces that does not need to make any excuses for itself. Once the tiger has been let out of the cage, it does not go back in without trying to turn its former captors into prey. In other words, it does not look like black people are going to sit down anytime soon unless Mr. Charlie figures out a way to strap us back down into the chair. Therefore, the strategic question is then not so much how to stop it, but how to win a civil war. And so, the misgivings about what you did tread into thin air. What's more, they all turn a blind eye to the concrete lessons taught to us by history. That is, the criticism and apprehension which I'm sure you've heard tend to ignore the extensive tradition of militant self-defense, which has consistently been the red thread capable of uniting the most advanced and revolutionary sectors of the black freedom struggle. Only by negating this legacy can one mistakenly suppose that racist terror will somehow disappear on its own or be checked by the authorities. Alas, I've written too much. With that said, if all this is too overwhelming, don't feel compelled to hurry when writing back. Even if I don't hear from you, I know that you're still around. To close, I should mention that in difficult times, with their disorienting ups and downs, I find myself telling my friends more often and in earnest that I love them. Love and solidarity, Idris Robinson. Okay, one more, and then I'll leave you guys alone, all right? So, this one is hard, because you got to get in like the right headspace for it, but to not mess it up. Okay. All right. Listen. So, this is about what happened in 2020, or what happened in the past year or so, since the pandemic or so. All right. Listen. What happened? Well, what had happened was, boom. 574 riots, 2,382 cases of looting. On top of all that, 97 cop cars set ablaze, 13 cops themselves were shot, and 9 of them ISIS by hit and runs. So I can tell you what did not happen. What transpired from May to June of 2020 was not a series of, quote-unquote, mostly peaceful protests. Nor was it initiated by some stupid white boy in a Hawaiian t-shirt. Indeed, the fear of Black Revolutionary Initiative runs so deep in this country that both liberals and conservatives, MSNBC and Fox News, are competing to see who can devise the craziest of conspiracy theories. All of this to simply obscure the facts about who triggered one of the largest and most widespread uprisings in American history. James Bowman once said, "One of the dangers of being Black in America is being schizophrenic." And I mean schizophrenic in the most literal sense. Yet, for a brief moment, long enough to both literally and figuratively catch a breath, the roles were reversed. Their confusion became our sanity. Their chaos became our peace. But most of all, amongst the mass of isolated, lonely, autonomous citizen deputies, the undead of the American wasteland, with their incurable neuroses and deranged habits, we saw for the first time a slight glimpse of humanity. It was the initiation of the Fanonian Humanist Project, laid out at the end of the Wretched of the Earth, a real civilizing mission. But only for those who participated on almost a spiritual level, with body and soul, in the non-movement rather than the social movement. Running with the field Negroes who got loose on banks and got loose on parole offices. But even I can feel their chains getting tighter. And I wonder how much longer they're going to let me stand up here or sit down here and talk this kind of shit. That is to say, after a year of plague, unrest, and natural disaster, so much has happened, but still so much remains the same. For instance, besides black people, 99.9% of Americans continue to fall into two categories, which reflects this country's two-party system. Either they're overtly racist or just narcissistic and annoying. Far too often, it's some awful admixture of both. In other words, when the crisis erupts and the repressed make their return, the defense mechanisms go into full swing. This is why the jargon of academics now sounds all the more hollow and empty. Indeed, it seems like only Yannick Giovanni Marshall and Dr. Joy James had the courage to say what needed to be said. Meanwhile, the rest of the black intelligentsia went on trying to articulate their own unique mode of bourgeois suffering. Self-obsession seems to be the best way to ignore black agency, as they've been utterly incapable of addressing their brothers and sisters in the streets, burning and looting. Be sure, our society still mobilizes all of its efforts to elaborately avoid the fundamental problem. It is not about diversity and inclusion, nor is it about treatment of the people of color, whoever or whatever they are. It's the fact that black niggas and not BIPOCs are locked down in prison, and mostly everyone, and likely even you yourself, at least on a subconscious level, believes that they actually belong there. It's the fact that every other day, some white boy shoots up a school or a supermarket, but nothing invokes more fear in an American's heart than a young black man with the air freshener dangling from his rearview mirror. Peace.
Thank you, Idris. And now, Shimon.
I don't want to waste any time. I don't have a great desire to give talks. In an effort not to waste your time, I will try to say something that is true inside of me. I'm an exploding volcano inside, so apologies if everything is not clear and well thought out. With your generosity, perhaps we can think through this moment together. The reason I'm feeling this way is because the leading intellectuals of the Black radical tradition, and I'm going to name them, Robin Kelly, Angela Davis, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, Kianga Taylor, and the most foul of them all, Nikhil Singh, all have ignored the uprising and have turned it into defund, or what I call black social democracy, the ultimate betrayal. This has forced a reckoning inside me about what is the black radical tradition if the intellectual inheritors of the tradition are supporting social democracy. Apologies for the dogmatism and perhaps glossing over some of the nuances, but I must move forward with my argument. First, I'll lay out some of the basic points that I've argued over the last year with Arturo and I. Arturo and I have been a close collaborator, and we've written texts on Ill Will, It's Going Down, and other places, so you know where I'm coming from. Burning of the Third Precinct created a new language of communication that's not performative, but what him and I called revolutionary abolitionism of the carceral apparatus versus performative protests of sign holding, which dominate this country, and defund, which Arturo and I have called reformist abolitionism. Second, regarding what we've argued in the last year, is that this was a black-led multiracial uprising. Third, what we've argued is that this black-led multiracial uprising created a powerful division in the white proletariat. No longer could you say that all white proletarians were anti-black and racist. Too many white proletarians burned down cop cars, participated in the burning of the Third Precinct, so it created a new division in society amongst white people and ultimately all proletarians. Ultimately, the question of last year was not its relationship to defund, but to revolution. Seeing it in any other way is just fucked up. Conceptually, Arturo and I's argument rested on black liberation, or the black radical tradition. We were trying to reach the new species that Fanon talked about, but we find that the leading revolutionaries, or so-called revolutionaries, of the black radical tradition turned it into defund. And when you talk about defund, you're not talking about the new Fanonian species. You're talking about normalized subjects of our society once again, and all that goes with that, and anti-blackness and whatnot. Whether Arturo and I are correct using the foundations of the black radical tradition has yet to be determined. Whether it is an internal problem of the tradition or a problem external to the tradition, such as white supremacy and anti-blackness, is unclear and certainly complicated. So this got me to think about two relationships we can think about the George Floyd uprising with the past. The first is inspired by Nick Astizi's book title, Our History is Our Future. And I just want to think about that phrase, our history is our future. I don't care about the rest. So you might, using that title, you might draw a direct line from slave revolts to the uprising, or Marunage to the uprising, right? And in some ways, that's what Arturo and I tried to do. Or for some of you, you might have watched Joy James's conversation yesterday. She could not see the uprising as a unique, transformative event because she judged it based on the merits of national liberation and armed struggle, which cannot explain the uprising. She could not see what we have to base our assessments on mass popular struggles and what the uprising was. The uprising for her was amateurish, childish, just messing around. Okay, moving on to the next relationship with time. Mario Tronti, and I quote, said, "We have no models. The history of the past experiences serves only to free us from those experiences." I want to run with this and show you what I think I'm trying to do. And I want to particularly focus on this quote and style of thinking because there are too many blockages in the current moment. This has been inspired for me by how many people read Fanon or C.L.R. James but did not participate in the uprising or have drawn reformist conclusions such as Robin Kelly or Nikhil Singh and company. This odd thought entered my mind a few weeks ago, so I'm still working it out. These thinkers, whether it's Robin Kelly or Frantz Fanon, seem to have exhausted their revolutionary potential, their impetus. It does not seem that those thinkers or those events generate a dynamism amongst the very people who read and believe in those texts and events of the past. My loyalty is to the uprising, and if we're going to save Fanon from reformism, black social democracy, reformist abolitionism, ultimately, we and the proletariat must finish the logical conclusion of the uprising. And the question is, can the black radical tradition make sense of the tactical, strategic, and political questions raised last summer? Can it innovate based on the uprising? So far, the answer has been largely no. Defund is not a tactical innovation. It is the defeat of last summer's uprising. But by thinking through Tronti's quote, I hope we're able to more clearly grapple with what occurred. And to be clear, Tronti's quote is not alien to the Black Liberation Movement. C.L.R. James wrote about this in Notes and Dialectics, the constant overthrowing of old radical heroes or shiros. In Black Jacobin, C.L.R. James talks about Toussaint murdering Moisey, who was leading a slave revolt. So it might seem like this is an external imposition, but those who know the tradition know that there have been many who've also thought along the lines of Mario Tronti. Even if I'm wrong, I hope to provoke a debate. And if I end up being proven wrong, that's great. So this is less a firm position than my thinking out loud on my feet. Someone once told me that comrades are for taming your intellectual and theoretical excesses. So I'll hope that you'll participate in taming my excessive ideas. Why might this type of line of thinking be necessary? First, the type of polarizations in the 1960s versus the George Floyd uprising. They're fairly different, right? And if you think about the polarizations that occurred this time, they were defund versus fuck 12, right? Not even abolition. Most of the kids who probably burnt the precinct down probably weren't thinking abolition. They were thinking fuck 12, right? BLM versus the proletariat, white outside agitators versus race traitors, right? So there's a set of polarizations that if you think about that occurred in the 1960s aren't the same in terms of how they're playing out right now. A second question or point, the problem of translation, right? So when we think about, I'll just say it, right? So you have the Paris Commune, right? But in the United States, you have the Sea Islands, the experiment in the Sea Islands and the Civil War. You have Soviets in Russia. You don't have that in the United States. You have national liberation in the global South. You have the BLA in the United States. Every country, maybe even region, has its own path to liberation. What I'm trying to get across with the problem of translation is that revolutionaries oftentimes try to take up what's happening overseas and try to map it directly onto the United States, right? And part of the difficulty for many US-based revolutionaries is the belief that we do not have a revolutionary tradition, so we look somewhere else, right? And to be frank, we do and we don't, because it's always been bent and shaped by white supremacy, which has powerfully contained or shaped our revolutionary tradition. Whether it's slave revolts, civil war, labor struggles, the riots of 67 or 68, it's all there, but they're all shaped by the racial contradictions of this country. The Black movement is the perfect example of this problem. Overall, the movement has wanted state recognition, but has ended more radical than its own intentions because of the anti-Blackness of this country. And to be frank, and a lot of people don't like hearing this, but it's inseparable with its relationship with white proletarians and white people in general. In other words, it's not the relationship with indigenous people which is central, or Latinx people, and definitely not Asian Americans. I'm sorry, right? But with whites, because whites are the demographic majority, and they are the ones who have bled for Black people, and they are also the ones who have lynched Black people, right? Show me a mass site, graves of Asian or Latinx or indigenous people who have died in a civil war for Black liberation. You won't find it in the United States. In other words, the Black struggle in this country cannot leap ahead of what white proletarians do. And that is why race traders are so important. And we see this exact structural argument in Du Bois's Black Reconstruction. We see this exact structural argument in C.L.R. James's Black Jacobins. He returns to France to think about the relationship of the French Revolution and the Haitian Revolution. You see this most importantly in Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism. Cedric Robinson, interestingly enough, starts the book by looking at European history, right? The relationship is central. Whether Latinx people will become serious collaborators with Black people is yet to be seen. And I raise that because now they're becoming a gigantic demographic proletarian force in this country. I'm not talking about 40 activists, 40 anarchists or communists or whatever, right? People do that a lot with Afro-Asian solidarity. They'll look at Grace Lee Boggs and James Bogg and be like, look, Black and Asian people were friends, Afro-Asian solidarity. I'm militantly against that kind of Afro-Asian solidarity. I think it makes solidarity into a joke, trite, and I think it's mostly just performative, right? We need to see millions of proletarians dying for the Black struggle. That's solidarity. And the proletarians who've done it are white proletarians. The ghost of the 1960s still haunts us. The legacy of the Panthers, for example, which I do not think is helpful in making sense of what happened last year, let alone what to do, right? The mutual aid formations that exploded last year in the beginning of the pandemic. Lots of radical people, and I know this is a touchy subject because of what was at stake, but it ended up being Red Charity, but it was inspired by the Panthers, right? Red Charity. The 10-point program, which is exhausted, and is ultimately, if you look at it carefully, is nothing but Black social democracy, right? And we all know if the Panthers were, well, I've seen it. I've seen Panthers in Rochester, New York, shut down riots. And so if the Panthers were alive today, which some of them are, they shut down riots. They do not participate in the riots. That's been my experience from last summer. What this allows us to do, right, thinking this way, right, and I don't know if this is particularly new or game-changing for many of y'all. Maybe you figured it out, but for me, it's been rather very shattering, right, is to take the George Floyd uprising seriously and use that as a demarcation for moving forward. My concern is that this uprising will just be a blimp, when in fact we must look at this is producing a new horizon, theory, organization, strategy, and tactics. It almost feels like no one wants to take into account what a Black-led uprising meant. We liked participating in it. We liked feeling its energy. We liked drawing the energy from a Black uprising. We liked talking about a Black uprising, but it cannot end there. It seems to be too hot to handle theoretically, organizationally, as a way to transform our lives and our political actions. The question I'm interested in now, right now, is how does it change our way of life? How does it change our practices and so on? How does it change everything? No one actually wants to explore what Wilderson's end of the world concept means. It is not a metaphor to me. We should be ripping our brains out of our skulls based on what happened last year. And I know I just fell into a metaphor, but let me be more concrete. It seems like if this occurred, this type of uprising would have occurred in France or Italy. People in the United States, radicals, anarchists, and communists would have redirected their politics and used those events in France or Italy to transform their behaviors and their ways of acting and thinking. But the Black question and the Black uprising seems too hot to handle for everybody. Apologies if this sounds like identity politics or accusing anyone in this space. It's not what I'm trying to say or do. That's not where I'm coming from. I must rip my own brain out of my skull and begin a process of ending myself. What will remain, whether it'll be a corpse or a new human, is irrelevant. The logical conclusions must be completed. Otherwise, our commitments to Black liberation, overthrowing the state, are just rhetoric and performative. So another thing that can be produced out of thinking that way is realizing that a new party or a new left or something, I know party is a bad word, but a new formation was created last summer, right? It was the people who participated and supported the uprising, the rioting, the looting, the burning of the third precinct, versus all the people who did jack or who were against it, or who turned it into defund, right? And that should change how we think about a set of questions. First is the type of divisions that we think about, right? So you have concepts that, if some of you read Ill Will, for example, real versus social, riot versus protest, class analysis or not, white race traitor or settler forever, or white race traitor and outside agitator, right? The intellectual tasks, right, is to see how the horizon of revolution is developed through class struggle. And perhaps on a more guerrilla intellectual level, our task is to defend the uprising, and in particular, the proletarians, not only through bail funds, for example, but also by setting the record straight in the way that W.E.B. Du Bois did in Black Reconstruction. Organizational questions. It's clear from the 1970s and before in the American context that vanguard Leninist groups do not work, but that still leaves us with some kind of coordination problem. The Third Precinct is an excellent example of that. The Third Precinct was burnt down, but nowhere were we coordinated enough anywhere around the country to recognize the centrality of that event and coordinate the continuation of that process. Instead, it was left to luck and a series of tactical successes or not successes. And ultimately, there were no more precincts that were burnt down. Having some type of organizational formation that could have caught the intensity of the Third Precinct and discussed with other comrades that more had to be done was not done, right? So the need for organization emerges out of the defeat or failure of the uprising itself. Uncomfortable truths, right? And some of this gets me in a lot of trouble because people don't like uncomfortable truths, right? And I got in a lot of trouble for some of this last year, right? I noticed when I went out to the riots, there were three factors, at least on the East Coast, I don't know about the West Coast, that told me instantly a riot was going to happen. The first was I saw that the normal suspects who come to protests weren't, there were additional people, proletarians from the hood, right? In New York City, Albany, Rochester, so on and so forth. You can tell people if you've been in the left, who's in the left and who's not in the left. And I realized, whoa, there's a lot of people in these things that aren't in the left. The second condition was people were smoking weed and drinking alcohol. Leftists on the East Coast don't do that kind of stuff in protest. And third, and this is what gets me in a lot of trouble, is the battle cry of the uprising on the East Coast was NYPD suck my dick, right? And of course, comrades have told me that's homophobic, it's transphobic, all these type of things. I acknowledge that. All I'm pointing out is this was the battle cry of the proletariat. It wasn't abolition. It wasn't C.L.R. James. It wasn't Marx, blah, blah, blah. It was NYPD suck my dick. When that chant came out, the bricks came out. Okay. And then I'm going to just run through a few of the other limits. We can talk about them if we want. The limits of feminism became very clear in the uprising. The limits of transformative and restorative justice became very clear in the uprising. The famous chant of who keeps us safe, we keep us safe, I would argue we cannot keep ourselves safe right now. When we create autonomous zones, this should blow our fucking minds. It's Black people who are killed in the autonomous zones that we set up, i.e. Seattle and the Chaz, right? Those are some real fucking challenges that we have to face. Ultimately, what this shows is the distance between ourselves and the proletariat. And if we can't be honest about that distance, I'm not sure what we're trying to do. I really don't know. My last line of thought. there are two movements which emerged. Well, two big movements which emerged after the uprising. And this also pisses off a lot of people. Palestine solidarity and the anti-Asian protests, right? And I'm gonna talk about them, but I'm not, I argue that they're both constituted by a type of anti-blackness, but it's not the type of anti-blackness that Frank Wilderson argues for. It's kind of a different type of anti-blackness that I'm trying to work, a different conceptual way of thinking about anti-blackness than what Frank Wilderson has argued for. The energy of the black movement creates the conditions for new movements to develop, but then they all seem to contain powerful strains of anti-blackness. It's not about what these two movements say, because everyone says they're against anti-blackness, everyone is, you know, against the police now in the movement. It's about what these two movements do, right? In the United States, and I'm talking, when I talk about Palestine solidarity, it's about in the United States. Right? And what these two movements do, as far as I'm concerned, is that they say we are legible citizens who know how to participate in the democratic debate with power. That, to me, is anti-black. They have disavowed the unique form of communication that was developed last summer, burning down the Third Precinct, looting, destroying cop cars for legible practices of peaceful protests. We do not seem to have an answer to this contradiction. And of course, the tension is that Asians and Arabs participated in the George Floyd uprising and did some wild shit. And it's worth noting that they did this in the context of black liberation. So I don't want to throw those Asians and Arabs under the bus. But when those identities get rearticulated as separate movements, as Stop Asian Hate or as Palestine Solidarity, they become something different. In other words, for non-black people, the language of Black Lives Matter now is about social mobility. Incorporation into the American empire. Again, this is not about Afro-pessimism for me. It's about strategy, tactics, and politics. So many people like to talk about decolonization and anti-imperialism with Palestine solidarity. But as far as I'm concerned, they're empty words. What is decolonization and anti-imperialism other than a direct attack on the US state? And where is Palestine solidarity when it comes to this? Absolutely nowhere. This is why I've come to think Palestine solidarity is the ultimate performative politics, because there's nothing at stake as it is currently posed. And I know some professors lose their jobs, but frankly, it has no fucking impact on what happens to Palestinians in Palestine, which is my main concern when it comes to Palestine solidarity. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.